It's the True Faith Newcastle United podcast. Really quick note from me, Alex Hurst, before I leave you with Norman Riley's chat. So both Miguel Delaney of the Independents and Felix Jenkinson of Amnesty International to say that we were contacted by many listeners over the past week or so from the two podcasts we've done on the takeover so far. A lot of really kind words, which we are massively grateful for, and some, you know, some constructive criticism as well, which is fine and good to receive. And we did promise that we would allow the people who have an issue with this takeover to put forward their side of the story. You all heard Norman on the last podcast, or you mostly will have heard him on the last podcast with me and Michael Martin, while we talked through the idea of the media and Newcastle United fans. He has interviewed both lads for you all today. I know no one would do this, but if there's any disagreements or any issues with either of them, just remember that they did this of their own free will. No one gets paid for this. They happily came and spoke to us kind of on your behalf so that you could listen to the arguments. You know, doesn't mean everyone has to agree. It doesn't mean that the True Faith podcast agrees or disagrees with them, but I would absolutely hate it if anyone was, you know, a dickhead basically towards either of them for coming and doing this, because even though I, for example, with Miguel, who I like very much as a bloke, I, you know, vastly disagree with him on the Newcastle United takeover. He thinks it shouldn't go ahead and has written about as such. I'm desperate for it to go ahead. I can't fault him in how he's behaved, how he's spoken about the football club, its history, and the fact that he spent time giving us this this interview for this podcast says a lot about him, says a lot about Felix. So disagreements, absolutely champion. Don't be a bell end and abuse anyone. The lads certainly don't need me to defend them or talk on their behalf. They haven't asked me to do this, but I just would hate for anyone to be abused for anything that they said in the podcast, because it's no good. But you all know that anyway. Keep it with True Faith next week. Hopeful of an announcement. We're going to have some great big podcasts with lots of input on the future, the beautiful future of Newcastle United, you know, that we hope will happen. So I'll stop talking now, over 2 minutes. I meant to talk for 30 seconds. Here's Norman and Miguel.
I'm Norman Riley, and I'm delighted to be joined by Miguel Delaney. Miguel is chief football writer at The Independent and has very recently put out a few tweets on the prospect of Newcastle being bought out by a consortium from which the majority of the finance will come from the Saudi Arabian government's public investment fund. Those tweets and your article, Miguel, generated, I think it'd be fair to say, a heated reaction. So TF thought it'd be good to chat with you, and to your credit, you've done so. Thank you very much, mate, and how are you doing?
Not too bad. Adapting, I'd say, to lockdown. Well, it's interesting, even beyond this Newcastle story, the football news cycle has actually been relentless because of all the stuff about getting back to playing football, about issues like furloughing staff. So it's been quite weird in that sense. I expected it to be a lot quieter, but it hasn't been.
No, who needs football when you can just talk about football?
Football news, yeah.
Exactly. Well, I'll tell you what, mate. We'll get stuck into it. Then the first question: do you think the deal will go through?
Yeah, my gut is. I mean, obviously, at the time we're recording, it's very close. It just has to be ratified by the Premier League. Obviously, what they have to look at now is putting all the paperwork and all the connections through the owners and directors test. But of course, that raises the bigger question that we'll get into now over whether the owners and directors test is suitable and what it says about all this if the deal does go through.
True enough. We'll move on to the obviously the couple of the tweets that have caused such furore and heated debate. As I say, I think the main one, you know, you said, I'm quoting directly here, it's if there is Saudi involvement, a great club with a great tradition and community spirit would specifically be used as image enhancement / networking from issues like human rights, abuses / Yemen / the murder of Khashoggi. It would be lamentable and bears a lot of scrutiny. I don't think anyone disputes that the Saudi government carries out actions that are morally reprehensible. However, in terms of fans who've supported the club, that's part of the social fabric of the region all their lives, who families have supported the club for generations, whose descendants will go on to support the club. Do you think it's up to them to hold the actions of the Saudi government, or indeed any government organisation that purchases a football club, up to scrutiny?
No, it's not up to them. And to be fair, that's why I think despite some of the backlash, I have made a point of not or not attacking fans, although, to be honest, I have had a lot of backlash, and I think some of that does warrant calling out. But generally, no, I don't think it does fall on fans. And I do absolutely sympathise with fans this year, because this is, when you really break it down, it's a real moral dilemma. I think, as the second captain's podcast for the other day, it is a real frying pan into fire situation. Mike Ashley was a terrible owner. I did this in a piece last August. It's an indictment of English football that a situation allowed where someone that doesn't have the primary interests of the club at heart is allowed on a club in the first place. And it begs huge questions of how we own clubs or how ownership structures are constructed in this country. But then that equally applies to Saudi Arabia, because the primary interest here is not Newcastle. That's all a byproduct for something that is very nakedly political. And I mean, I suppose you mentioned all the fans and what it means to them. But that's precisely why this is important. Because clubs are ultimately social institutions. They're representations of the community. And in many towns, many cities across Britain, they're often the only social hub left. I mean, we did a piece last May related to the potential death of the 72 due to changes in the game, which obviously become a much more prominent issue with coronavirus and economic threat to so many clubs. And like I was talking to people in government who say, or more so in kind of local authorities, they actually lean on football clubs because they are the only social hub left. Everything else is gone. They're often the only thing holding clubs together. So they're a hugely important place in society. And I think it's a disgrace that noble concept could be bought up and distorted into something like this, which would really just be an instrument of foreign policy for one of the most criticised states on earth. I mean, I've done the piece this morning. It was over a week in the making. We basically spoke to every academic and expert on the area on Saudi Arabia, and they're quite blunt about this. This was all, I mean, the word they all use is sports washing, and that's not just about image cleansing. That's also about forging connections, integrating yourself into the West. So basically, the message is these are good people to do business with. But that's all to deflect from what is happening in their country. And this again is one of the three most criticised countries on earth. And what this is about is the political use of the club and its fans. And that's why it's so insidious and really so disturbing. And I think it greatly saddens me that Newcastle fans and the club could be used in that way.
I mean, you know, all very valid points. I think from a fan's perspective, I think the difficulty is, and what a lot of the reaction has been, is that obviously I think a lot of fans take any sort of holding the club to account as a criticism of them directly. So I suppose from my perspective, it's, you know, it can be a moral dilemma for many people, but, you know, Newcastle fans will go and support that team. And I suppose, you know, in terms of sports washing, we, you know, people are aware of what, you know, governments do. People are aware of what the Saudi government do, especially now. I mean, a lot of people who weren't quite aware will certainly be more aware now. But, you know, if people are aware of it happening, they can still, I suppose, go to matches and, you know, support that side and, I guess, support the, you know, the team, not the regime. And if people are actually aware of it, how does the whole sports washing concept work if the fans, you know, are off sort of thoroughly aware of what's actually going on, and they're not extending support for a regime, so to speak, they're just still supporting that club?
Well, I mean, just to answer the first point there, I mean, it is a view I actually sympathise with a lot. And I said this about Manchester City, and believe me, I've had a lot of, have to put this, exchanges with Manchester City fans over the last 2 years, particularly given our coverage over the treble and what the club is. We did this piece on the eve of the season. Which again is essentially a sports watching exercise for Abu Dhabi, who, let's not forget, are major allies of Saudi Arabia and have just run a war in Yemen with them, described as basically by all experts as the greatest humanitarian disaster on the planet. So that's just one other angle to why this deal should not go through, because the idea of having the Middle Eastern power bloc setting up a power base in English football like that it provokes a lot of uncomfortable questions. But in saying all that, the view I've always had with City fans is I completely sympathise the fact that no matter who buys your club, and I know this is a debate that's gone on with Newcastle fans as well about how to protest Ashley in the first place, and the issue of boycotting. It's not just as simple as making, you know, a stark decision, well, I'm not going to go or anything like that, because we know that connections to these clubs are built up over decades. There's like there's a real internalized psychological link that's just almost impossible to break. So in that case, I mean, I would feel personally that the most understandable response to this is, I suppose, happiness that Ashley is gone, and yet a level of discomfort with who these new owners are. I think that's completely fair. And it's also, and I know some Newcastle fans found this tweet inflammatory, was one word put to me, but I think this is a very sincere opinion. I think it's the best display of the power they actually have in this, which is that a banner of Jamal Khashoggi can put up. Because again, the whole reason they're buying the club, again, as it's sports washing, but that is, and almost every expert will attest to this in the area, that's something that's been ramped up since the death of Khashoggi because of the huge international backlash. But let's not forget, this, after that, there was a period where they went through 8 months of without having an ambassador in Washington, D.C. And it was essentially, according to some of the experts I quote in today's piece, Dr. Coates Ulrichsen, who's an expert in the area, it was essentially Abu Dhabi making representations on their behalf in Washington. So this all ramped up after Khashoggi. And so the entire point of this is to try and ultimately soften the image of the state after something, a crime as massive as that. And of course, it goes even more direct than this, because if the deal goes through, which we expect it will, 80% of the club will be owned by the Public Investment Fund. The Public Investment Fund is chaired by Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince, and the US Senate has passed a resolution holding him responsible for the murder of Khashoggi. So it's all about this. It's all about the political use of fans, and also the political use of the emotional power of fans. I mean, as we can already see, I know this is just a minority and they don't represent the fan base, but it is there, and they are quite high in number. There's so many fans on Twitter and social media who essentially going to bat for the regime and are arguing with Tusk about Saudi human rights abuses. This is sports washing in effect. So the way fans can really still support their team, but also show agency in this and undermine the very sinister reasons the club has been bought, is essentially to put up a banner of Jamal Khashoggi. I mean, that would horrify the Saudi owner. Suddenly, this big power play of theirs, which is the purchase of a club like Newcastle following on from Abu Dhabi's purchase of Manchester City, or Sheikh Mansour's, if you want to get into the whole the kind of fairly irrelevant debate about the power structures there. But this is why they bought it, and it would instantly undermine all that. And it would be such a powerful display. And also, I think a really reassuring and noble illustration of fan power at a time, particularly in Newcastle, when fans have never felt more powerless. Because this isn't trying to force Ashley out, which is obviously such an issue. This is something where you can have direct agency. And I would consider it similar to, like, there was a very interesting case with the Lyon fans when their games were moved for Chinese television. So what the fans responded was basically a massive TIFO of the Taiwanese flag as a political statement, which was beamed live. I'm not sure what they did in China. You'd have to assume they blurred the image of the flag, or similar to when Bayern Munich started business deals with Qatar and their fans protest, something that happens a lot in Germany.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they've got the advantage of the, 51% of the club being owned by the fans, whereas obviously I think any Newcastle fans, and, I get what you're saying, absolutely, but at the same time, any Newcastle fans who took a flag such as that in the stadium would be likely to be banned straight away, and obviously that would, reinforce the point that you're trying to make, and obviously other people are trying to make in terms of free speech, etc., with regards to a regime that suppresses it. However, I suppose I will have to kind of ask you this: if that's something that the fans could do, in that case, let's think of players, managers, coaches. For a start, any kind of player or manager signing on the dotted line for this particular regime, are they not held up to the same kind of, I suppose, levels of moral scrutiny, if not more, than the fans themselves? And also, in terms of journalists, let's see a Newcastle press conference, for example. Will we see journalists wearing Jamal Khashoggi T-shirts?
It's not a bad idea. I think it should be done. And to be fair, I wouldn't be demanding this of the fans. I'm just saying it's a suggestion that I think would be very powerful. I wouldn't expect, as you say, there's all sorts of complications to it. But I do think it would be a powerful gesture. I think the one about players and managers is interesting because it's something that's come up with City as well. I suppose this is where there is a bit of a dividing line and where this conversation does get a bit blurred, because then it becomes about, and this is something that's come up in my response as well, about the system we live in. And essentially, to exist in it, we have to abide by structures that we don't agree with. And it is a very fair question. I mean, and it's that one ultimately, if you play for a club like this, are you in your own way legitimizing the regime? Is it moral to go to a club like this? It's a very hard question to answer, really, because I think it's often unfair to blame employees in a situation like this. But then I suppose that question is a bit more complicated when it's someone making the choice to go there, especially if, as is expected in this, it's for massive amounts of money, which is what many fans hope.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think this is the thing, you know. I think a lot of fans obviously feel that they're being held up in a different light to let's say people employed by the club, i.e., as I say, players, coaches, etc., and also journalists. I mean, obviously Khashoggi, you know, he was in the same industry as you, and yeah. I suppose you could look at it like this: any, you know, if fans are kind of expected to a certain extent to protest it, to let's say take a flag into the stadium, you know, why would journalists not as a form of solidarity not just refuse to report on the club, you know, to refuse to engage? Would that not? It sounds like I'm engaging in what about here, but I suppose I'm putting it to you because obviously that's, you know, these are the kind of concerns that have been raised amongst fans.
Well, funnily enough, actually, first the one thing I would say is, in principle, I don't think, and I think this would be an ethical consideration of the profession, really. I don't think journalists should ever boycott anything because the job, because especially in a case like this, when part of it is about putting out an image, so that image needs to be challenged. But what I would say, and I think where you're perfectly right, the journalists shouldn't report this case like as if they're a normal football club. And the exact same applies to Man City. And to be honest, and I would very much include myself in this, I would say for a long time, I failed at the reporting of Man City. And we basically just treated it like a normal club. And, you know, we talked about all the great football, all the rest of it. And like in the case of Man City, there were two things that really opened my eyes and kind of made and really pushed me into what I wrote last summer when they won the domestic treble. One was an article by Nick McGeehan, who has previously worked for Human Rights Watch and is still a human rights activist for Fair Square, in which it was in December 2017 when he did a big piece about what Abu Dhabi actually are, and this isn't just some kind of vanity project. And then, of course, just over a year later, when Football Leaks came out, and it really painted exactly what the powers in Manchester City were doing in football. And there is that quote. I think it's such a telltale quote about the whole thing. It's from Simon Pearce, who is a high-up official at Manchester City, but is also one of MBZ, who is the ruler of Abu Dhabi, essentially, is one of his most trusted advisors. And it was basically in an email about, I can't remember the exact details of the quote, but it was something about, obviously, the dates of some sort of deal or something. But his quote was, "We can do whatever we want." So this was something that really, I suppose, probably opened my eyes. And it's why we're having this discussion among journalists at Wembley when they destroyed Watford 6-0, won a treble. And it just felt so soulless, the whole thing, because this was, right, even within the modern Premier League context, Watford, a wealthy club, wealthier than most European clubs, and they just couldn't compete with this, the most lavishly funded project on earth, who were kind of looking to kind of almost bend football to their will. And it just didn't feel like football. This wasn't normal. And again, which ties into the whole question of what they're trying to do and what the purpose of this is. I remember just thinking that day, like, I'm not going to report this like it's a normal match, because it's not. And it's why, like, I mean, I don't think you'll ever find many other FA Cup final reports in history that make references to the bombing in Yemen. And we were discussing, or sorry, the war in Yemen. But we were discussing afterwards among ourselves. I mean, given what Abu Dhabi is trying to do with the club, and now the same will apply with Saudi Arabia and Newcastle, should we just allow them to spread that message and challenge? This is something that should regularly come up in press conferences. It should be mentioned all the time. And any time the club is reported on, even if we do have to go through the usual rigmarole of reporting on the team and their wins, it should at the very least be clarified what this is. Because in Ollie Holt did make a great point in his what was an excellent column by him on Sunday, where he said, like, with City, this is the kind of the problem of the beautiful football. It creates the subliminal link to the state and even subconsciously softens the image of the state, which is why journalists shouldn't treat this like a normal football team.
Right, so I mean, well, that's very interesting that you say that. And again, I think, it kind of addresses, if journalists are going to, have a go at fans, let's say, then I guess, they've got to kind of get their own backyard in order first. So it would be interesting to see what plays out next season, whether or not obviously any journalists are just kind of pretty direct with people employed by the club about who they're working for. Let's see if that happens. And it kind of does tie into the next couple of questions. You've obviously had a bit of comeback about the fact that you work for the Independent and there's a 30% ownership by Sultan Mohammed Abdul Jadiel, a Saudi businessman. And obviously, I guess the other thing as well is, an article that you wrote about the potential of the Saudi takeover of Man United a couple of years ago. That wasn't as hard hitting, I guess, as how you've gone in at Newcastle, I suppose. The opinions do change over a couple of years. I'm not going to dispute that. And you just mentioned that as well. But I guess Man U as well. Am I right in thinking they have a commercial partnership with Saudi Telecom? And I don't recall hearing much kind of scrutiny of that. So again, these are just points that have been raised. And I'd be interested, how what your opinions are there.
Yeah, and fair questions. The one thing I would say in relation to, and this has come up a lot, it came up a lot of the City thing, and I did a piece about this in February 2018. Obviously, we'd rather clubs didn't do business with the Saudi state at all. But that is kind of the system we live in, that we have to kind of, coexist with or coexist in. But that's still several levels removed from the PIF owning, chaired by MBS, owning Newcastle as a direct political instrument. And the same applies to the structure of the Independent. It's just not comparable. As regards the Independent, I mean, the greatest relevance here is it's editorial independence. I mean, I know you've got the Independent chief football writer myself, who's, essentially criticising Saudi Arabia at will. Also, the paper, or now the website, should I say, has been, leading the way on criticism of the Khashoggi case. Its coverage in the Middle East is the most respected in the world, let's say. It's mostly through the work of Robert Fisk. So I just think that's kind of a non-issue. And it feels like one of those things where, rather than engage with the point, which I think is a very, very serious point, and it's a point made, let's be fair, about it's the protection, or it's a point in the best interest of Newcastle, we could argue. There's so much talk that, you're just jealous of us, you don't want to see us succeed. That's not the case. This is about what the best interests of a great club are, and it saddens me that a club like that would be used in this way. And that's the kind of the fundamental point there. And in relation to the Manchester United thing as well, what I would say there is that Manchester United piece, which remember leads with the disappearance of Khashoggi, that is mentioned straight up the top. It hadn't yet come out that he'd been murdered yet. And dismembered. I mean, I think the grotesquery of that crime should be brought up at every step. But that was ultimately just laying out, because it was just a rumor at that point whether the Saudis were interested in Manchester United. So all that was a short factual piece on whether the rumor was true. When there were similar rumors about Newcastle, I didn't write anything at all, and I certainly didn't go in on the moral stance of it all or what fans should do. So like that, I think that's a very unfair accusation to people, because I went nowhere near as far. And also, subsequently, that Manchester United piece, I literally described the potential Saudi takeover of Manchester United, one of the three biggest clubs on the planet, along with Barcelona and Real Madrid, probably, potentially bought out as a political instrument by one of the three most criticised states on the planet. So I don't think that stacks up. And to be fair, I've only kind of, a few months ago, I did say it would be on Twitter, I haven't written about it yet, it would be a very bad thing if Saudi Arabia bought Newcastle. But obviously, I've only kind of escalated the scrutiny of this and the discussion about it as the deal gets closer and as it looks like it's on the brink of happening, which is perfectly natural. So that would be the answer to the supposed difference in coverage of Manchester United. In fact, to be honest, had it happened with Manchester United, it would have been harsher because of the size and power of the club. Although there is actually another angle here. And this was put to me by, again, Dr. Coates Ulrichsen about this, that he almost thinks that a little bit like Manchester City with Abu Dhabi, Newcastle and their recent history are the perfect, and this is something worth considering. It's worth giving a lot of thought to. Newcastle are the perfect host organism, because that's what they would be, a host organism for a sports watching project like this, because it's a fan base that has felt almost a little bit marginalized, particularly in relation to coverage of Mike Ashley, because they're so desperate for some sort of savior. And as we've pretty much seen, any alternative to Mike Ashley is essentially praised, even though these are, I would say, by a million levels, morally worse than Mike Ashley. And that is really saying something, given all the coverage of, you know, how Sports Direct have treated staff. But because of all that, it almost means it's the perfect host organism for an operation like this, because it's a fan base almost desperate for something different and willing to engage, when really they should be engaging with the question of why this is being done in the first place.
Which, I mean, I think a lot of people are. You know, obviously, I think we're all very much aware of, you know, the Saudi regime, and as you say, what it's done, what it does and what it will continue to do. But I guess, you know, we'll go back to the original point of this being our football club. And I suppose what I would like to know is, you know, truthfully, would you judge fans who continue to go and watch that team? Would you have a negative opinion?
I absolutely wouldn't judge fans. No, I wouldn't judge fans going at all. The same with Manchester City fans. I totally get this is their team. And there is, I mean, you could also argue there is a little bit of defiance in that sense of kind of, The owner is never truly the club. The club is an identity unto itself that is really wrapped up in the fans. Owners come and go, the club doesn't. So almost kind of staying with it is an act of defiance in itself. But what would sadden me is fans basically arguing for the regime, you know, kind of pushing back against any sort of criticism. And I know that's only been a minority so far, but it is there. And that's what this one. Going to the games, absolutely not, because I think it's completely understandable. And it's absolutely fair for Newcastle fans to be conflicted about this. But it's their club. It's not Saudi Arabia's. And the danger is that Saudi Arabia try and distort it into something that it isn't.
Well, I don't think the fans will allow that to happen. And Miguel, I think that's a very good point to leave it on. We really appreciate you giving your time and the fact that you fronted up. So thank you very much, and all the best to you.
No problem. Cheers. I'd like to say it was enjoyable chat. Well, enjoyable chatting with you on it. Not necessarily enjoyable subject of chat.
True enough. Thank you. Cheers.
Hello, this is a True Faith podcast. I'm Norman Reilly, and I'm delighted to be joined by Felix Jagans, who is head of campaigns at Amnesty International. As most of you listening will know, Amnesty this week wrote to the Premier League authorities asking them to pay close attention to the proposed take of Newcastle United by a consortium involving the Saudi government. As listeners hopefully know, True Faith likes to try and speak to people and organisations that comment on the club, and Felix has agreed to do just that. Felix, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure. We'll just get straight into it then. First of all, can you explain to listeners the Amnesty position on the Saudi regime and, if possible, offer a couple of examples of the behaviour in which it engages that has led to Amnesty's condemnation?
Yes. So, in terms of the purchase of Newcastle, what we've been saying is that we see Saudi Arabia's interest and involvement in buying the club as not being about football, not being about business, but about trying to improve their reputation internationally. So it's a process that we've talked about as being called sports washing. So it's using high-profile sports. So that's been bringing sport to Saudi Arabia, which they've been doing a lot of over the last 18 months. probably the Anthony Joshua fight at the end of last year being the most high-profile example of that. And now they're kind of casting their net a little bit wider, and the acquisition of a very high-profile Premier League team seems to be what they've got their sights set on. We know they also made some inquiries at Man United, but the price was allegedly a little bit too high for them. So we've been commenting on this for some time and raising awareness of the fact that Saudi is trying to use sport in this way. I'll briefly touch on a couple of the kind of, you know, a couple of minutes probably isn't enough to talk about Saudi Arabia when it comes to human rights violations. They're pretty much bottom of the world league when it comes to human rights abuses. But sort of three categories, I suppose, that it's worth talking about. So firstly, the conflict in Yemen. So that's something which the UK government has been helping to fuel. But the Saudi-led coalition has been leading an indiscriminate bombing campaign in the country that has wrecked the infrastructure and has left Yemen on the brink of famine and collapse. They've indiscriminately targeted civilian targets throughout the campaign, so schools, hospitals, mosques, and some of your listeners may remember unfortunately targeted a bus full of school children on their way to school, killing over 30. So the conflict in Yemen is one area of concern for Amnesty. Another very high profile incident was the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. So he's a journalist who was critical of the regime. Not someone who has a totally unchecked background, but went into the Istanbul consulate and was murdered brutally and dismembered there. And while he's denied all knowledge and involvement, the CIA and the United Nations have said that a level of accountability will stretch all the way up to Mohammed bin Salman, who will become effectively the de facto owner of Newcastle United. And then just broadly, sort of, there's a big issue in the kingdom around, you know, there's a complete lack of civil society. There's no transparency. There's no independent journalism. Dissent or criticism of the royal family and of the crown prince is completely not tolerated. So anybody who is caught speaking out against them is liable to kind of disappear, face torture, and potentially the death penalty. And that's the final thing that I'd say is they're a very prolific user of the death penalty. Over 180 executions documented by Amnesty last year alone, and their favourite method is still beheading. Which is often followed by crucifixion of the corpse. And we've seen that being handed out to, in one case, someone who was 10 years old at the time of the crime, 13 at the time of conviction. So some pretty significant stuff. And, you know, if we were seeing reform as an organisation in Saudi Arabia, we would talk about it. It's not our purpose to make a case where there isn't one to be made, but with Saudi, there really is.
Okay, thank you for that. In terms of sports washing, now, the concept of sports washing, what would you foresee that entailing in, let's say, a region like Tyneside if the purchase did go through? And I suppose, obviously, you know, we can guess at what it might entail, and that will bring undoubtedly a lot of economic benefit to the northeast of England, which I'm sure you're aware is a relatively economically deprived area and has been for quite a while. So whilst this investment's going on in the region and whilst there's obviously a lot of positivity generated from it, I think it's obviously going to be difficult for people to square off, you know, that immediate improvement in the life in the region with what's actually happening thousands of miles away. So I suppose the question I'm asking really is, you know, what do you see, what do you actually see this sports washing entailing in terms of what they do?
Sure. So it's really about constructing a different narrative about Saudi Arabia. So rather than the conversations that people are having about Saudi as being negative, about the things I've just talked about, so about indiscriminate bombing, about the death penalty, about the fact that you can get a death penalty just for being gay in Saudi Arabia, the conversation starts to be about Saudi Arabia as a benefactor, Saudi Arabia as a great place to go to sport, Saudi Arabia a bringer of bringing success to a club like Newcastle. In terms of sports washing, what this process does is it goes a long, long way beyond Newcastle. So while Newcastle is the club that Saudi Arabia are looking to acquire, this process is Newcastle is just one part of it. So the Premier League is the most watched league in the world. It's screened in basically every country anyone can think of. So when people are making those associations with Saudi Arabia in the Premier League, they won't necessarily be thinking about the money that's going into Tyneside and the success that's going there. They'll be thinking about, they'll be making that association in the same way that people will with, you know, now with Man City and their owners. And that's being viewed in countries all over the world. And people are seeing, well, we're seeing what's happened at PSG. We're seeing what's happened at Man City. These countries can take ownership of the club, and it creates a different narrative about what that country's all about. So it's not just about Newcastle as a city and a region. It's about that global perspective that being very closely involved with the Premier League brings.
All right. So Kate Allen, your UK director, in her letter to the Premier League, stated the following. I'll just quote directly here. Whether or not this deal goes ahead, we're calling on Newcastle United staff and fans to familiarise themselves with the dire human rights situation in Saudi Arabia and be prepared to speak out about it. When Amnesty says fans should be prepared to speak out, what exactly would it expect or hope to see? And, you know, what does Amnesty, I suppose, believe Newcastle fans can do to help the people for whom it's campaigning?
Right, exactly. And that's a great question. And, you know, we've always said that we're not opposed to the deal happening. It genuinely isn't up to us to decide who should or shouldn't own a football club, right? What we're doing is we're trying to make the human rights record of Saudi Arabia part of this conversation. And I think we've succeeded in doing that. And the fact that, you know, people creating content for fans like yourselves are willing to have this conversation, to hear what Saudi are all about, to consider it, to talk about it in their podcasts, on their websites, that is breaking the spell of sports washing, because you're not, you know, you're not just saying they're great unequivocally, let's wave this through. You know, by us having this conversation and by others having those conversations, it's putting human rights in that story, and it's shining a light on who Saudi really are. So that, you know, all we're asking fans to do is be aware of who these guys are, be aware of what this represents, and, you know, talk about it, right? Raise each other's awareness, and, you know, that's as far as we're going. We're not calling on anyone not to, you know, to boycott or anything like that. We're saying, be aware of what this is about, have it as part of your conversations, think and talk about it as fans.
Yeah, fair enough. So next question, we kind of answered this, but, you know, one of the questions I got was, has the horse not bolted your football in 2020 is a business and there are dodgy owners aplenty? What would Amnesty say to those who say that criticism of this takeover is simply look at me liberalism?
Well, I mean, you know, our role as a human rights organisation is to raise human rights concerns, and we've done that with UAE and Man City. We've done it with everybody that's gone to participate in sport in Saudi Arabia. Just if you put into Google any of those sports, plus Amnesty, plus sports washing, when it comes to Saudi, we've had something to say. We did a lot of work around the Anthony Joshua fight, for example. We've had similar things to say about Qatar, both in terms of their involvement with PSG, but also the World Cup. So, you know, Newcastle fans are getting this criticism, or they're hearing this criticism now, because this deal is going through now. And we're trying to make sure that the Premier League are aware that we see this as sports washing, and that we see it as something which we want them to look carefully at.
Yeah. Has Amnesty ever had any dialogue it could deem positive directly with the Saudi government or via intermediaries? Or is it, as you said earlier on, there isn't any sort of civil society, I think you said?
No, so Amnesty is banned from Saudi Arabia, as we are from a few countries in the world. And as far as I know, we've never had any positive dialogue with the Saudis in any forum.
Okay, so I mean, the last question was actually, as an organisation, what progress has been made in terms of Saudi Arabia because of pressure put on the regime by governments of other countries and or NGOs and pressure groups such as Amnesty? I think I've got a feeling what you're going to say here.
Well, it's, you know, Saudi Arabia are a very rich country. They do a lot of business with governments all over the world. So criticism is unfortunately not as forthcoming as we'd like it to be. We, you know, and as Amnesty International, we've documented so many human rights violations there that we wouldn't countenance with any other government. But because of their, you know, for whatever reason, their economic power, whatever it might be, governments tend not to be particularly critical. Now, we have seen some criticism. Canadian government and the French government have criticised some of what the Saudis have done. So, for example, one of the big reforms or touted reforms in Saudi Arabia is that women have recently been given the right to drive. Well, Amnesty has been working on the cases of a group of women who were calling for that right before it was made legal, three of whom were arrested and tortured in detention and are now facing huge prison sentences for calling for the right to drive. So when that was taking place, there were some governments who were speaking out against Saudi Arabia, but criticism doesn't tend to be particularly forthcoming often.
Can I just confirm, these are, and I just have to do this for purpose of this podcast, are these alleged or confirmed crimes that you've mentioned?
So we wouldn't consider them crimes, but they have been. It's not that these are alleged. They've been documented.
Okay. Yeah. Right. Okay. Well, thanks very much, Felix. We really appreciate you giving us a bit of your time. I know you're incredibly busy, so thank you for putting that side across. It's hugely appreciated, and all the best to you. Thank you.
Yeah, no worries. And you know, this is what we're really trying to do is have these, make sure these conversations are being had, and that people know, what's going on over there, what they're all about.